grass and
okay, so let's get started here. So I have had a bit of a illness, so my voice is broken up. Okay, so I'm going to speak a little softly. If you cannot hear me, move forward. Alright, so today's class is going to build on what we talked about last time, namely distributed systems and RPCs. Okay, so if you remember, we introduced this notion of client-server computing, and we said a good way to build distributed applications is through remote procedure calls or RPCs. Okay, the RPC abstraction essentially allows you to call, to invoke processes, or rather invoke functionality on remote processes using a method, a call or a function call. Okay, so it looks exactly like you're calling a local function, but the underlying RPC runtime takes care of communicating with the remote process, invoking the function on the remote process, doing the processing and returning the result. Okay, so this is one way for applications, distributed applications in particular, to communicate with one another. Okay, and today we are going to build on that knowledge and see how you go about designing distributed file system, and you will see how RPCs are actually used by distributed or network file systems for communicating between the client and the server. Okay, so what is a distributed file system? Distributed file system is a way by which you can access files stored on a disk of a remote machine on your local desktop or a laptop. Okay, and why is this useful? Okay, so let's assume that you have an environment where there are lots of workstations and laptops that are all connected to one another. Okay, each machine has a local disk, and there are some files that the user of that machine has stored on his or her disk drive. Okay, now what distributed file systems allow you to do is to access files on these other machines as if they were local files. Okay, instead of having to walk over to that machine and access files, you can actually sit on your local laptop or desktop and just access these files remotely. Okay, so basically, given a set of disks attached to different nodes, a distributed file system allows you to share these disks across these nodes as if all of these disks were attached to every node. Okay, so the abstraction you get is every disk that is on any machine looks like it's like a local disk, so you can access those files locally. Okay, there are several examples of how this works. Okay, the EdLab scenario, okay, is one where you have a small number of server class machines that have large disks or RAID drives, and these drives are then accessed by other machine. Okay, now workstations are not diskless, but they do have local disks, but they allow you to access files from remote servers. Okay, so this is basically a distributed file server using a client server paradigm. Servers are the ones that are sharing the data. Okay, or disks, and clients access these files on servers. Okay, there are other environments like Apple Share or others where every node in the that's on a network exports its some volumes, okay, or some number of files from the local disk, and every other node can access files on any other node. Okay, so in other words, every node can act both as a server, okay, where it is exporting some files for other clients to access, as well as a client where it can access files from other machines. And we'll see examples of all of this as we go along. Okay, so with that basic concept in mind, the ability to access files stored on remote disks, let us see what are some issues in designing distributed file systems. Okay, so we are going to look at several. Okay, naming and transparency is the first one. Then we'll look at remote file access models. We'll talk about caching in some detail. And we'll talk about stateful and stateless servers and replication, but not very briefly, not in as much detail as the rest. So let's start with naming and transparency. Okay, so what does this even mean? So since you are accessing files on a remote disk somewhere, okay, first question is how should the files be named so that you can actually get to a particular file stored on a remote disk. Okay, this is called the naming problem. Okay. Second issue is, do file names reveal their locations? Okay. Does the file name have to change if a file moves from one machine to another, one server to another? Okay. Does the name change if the user moves from one machine to another? Okay. So we'll think about all of these issues in some detail, but here are two ways to understand how distributed file systems are built. First one is called location transparency. Okay. If your distributed file system supports location transparency, then the file name by itself does not reveal the location of the file or the server where it is stored on. Okay, simplest example of this is your EdLab. Okay. So all of your 377 directories are basically in a structure that looks like this. Now, this name by itself, this may be the name of some user directory. Okay, so you could have something like Shenoy in here. Now, if you look at this name, this doesn't tell you where this directory or where these files are stored in your system. Okay, it doesn't tell you the name of the server. Okay, there's the data is stored on some server somewhere, but this name doesn't tell you where it is. Okay. In other words, this naming convention will be called location transparent, okay, because the name of the files or names of directories don't necessarily tell you which machines these files are stored on. Okay. Now, location independence basically says that the name of the file does not depend on its location, meaning that the file could actually move from one storage location to another, but then you can access the file with the same name. Okay. Now, it turns out that most file systems will have some form of location transparency, but location independence is harder to achieve. If the file actually moves from one server to another, typically you have to get to it using a different name. Okay. Now, the way to understand location independence is to take another example. Let's take the example of the web. Okay. Now, web is not a file system, okay, but it is a mechanism to share files. Okay. In the web, you have files that are hyperlinked that are stored somewhere on the server, and you can get to them from a client which is a browser. Okay. Now you can ask the question, is the web naming convention location transparent and is it location independent? Okay, so let's take a simple example. So let's take a file name. So this is a URL, yes, cnn.com/business/index.html. Okay. Is it location transparent based on our definition? It is location transparent. Does the file name tell you where its location is? Well, it doesn't tell you where the web server is, that you will not be able to know. But does it tell you what server it is stored on? So it tells you that it's on this server. Okay. So we would claim that based on that definition, okay, if this was a naming scheme employed by a file system, this is not location transparent. Okay. Because it has the server name embedded in the name. In order to get to this file called index.html, you have to specify the server. Okay. And we'll see examples of file systems that do the same thing. Is it location independent? Okay, suppose you move this index.html file, let's say you move it to some other website. So let's suppose you move it to, for whatever reason, let's say foo.com index.html. Okay, this file is moved to this server. And now the way to get to this file is to use this URL as opposed to that. Okay, is this location independent? Yes, no. If you move this file from this index.html file from this server to another server, okay, and then now this is the new name for that file, The question is this naming convention that's employed in the web location independent or not?
For index for the whole location independent? No.
Well, this is a name of a file, right? This whole thing is a name of a file. That's how, if you want to access that file in your browser, you have to specify this URL. So the whole name of the file is this. So it's clearly not location independent. Right? Because the name of, if you have location independence, then the name of the file should not change. Regardless of what server it is on, you have the same handle for the file. Okay, that's not the case here. Alright, so let's start with some naming strategies that are used in real file system. Okay, the simplest one is called absolute name. This is what you may actually be familiar with if you use Windows or Mac for that matter. Okay, the way you get to a file, a remote file, is through an absolute name which includes the machine name and the path name. Okay, in Windows, for example, if you want to create a network drive, okay, what you do is you do /\ server name, you put a volume, okay, and then this on your local machine gets mapped to some drive name, F drive or whatever you want to call it. Okay, this is called an absolute name because you're specifying the name of the server where it's stored on, that's the machine name, and you specify the full path name. So this could be, say, users U. Okay, so then you can actually mount your home directory on some other Windows server as a network drive on a local Windows client. Okay, same thing is true on a Mac. So if you use something like Apple File Protocol, the way you would specify it is you would do AFP, server name, and then volume name. Okay? And that creates a network drive on the machine. So these are called absolute names. Okay, you need to know name of the server as well as the file name in order to get to it. Now, this is also called a fully specified file name. Okay? Now, the advantage of this scheme is that you, since you know precisely what server and what directory and what file you are going after, specifying the name actually reveals everything about the file. It's easy to add or delete name. There is no global state you have to maintain. I mean, you are the user, have to keep track of where the files are, so the file system doesn't have to do any hard work on your behalf. You are going to specify everything. File system just gets to that file on that server. And it scales easily. Okay. So the disadvantage is that this has actually put the burden on you, the user, to figure out where the files are and how to get to them. Okay. So you have to keep track of whether your project is on server A or machine B. Okay. And then you have to specify this in order to get to it. Okay. You have to also figure out, is the file local or remote? Okay. File is location dependent and cannot move. If this file moves somewhere, its name is going to change. Okay. This makes sharing harder because users have to now remember where files are stored and so on and so forth. And it's not fault tolerant. If that server goes down that's specified in that name, then all files on that server become unavailable. Okay. So it's not tolerant to failures of servers. Okay. Now let's look at another strategy called mount points. Okay. Now in order to take the burden of remembering the server name and the path name away from users, what some file systems like NFS, which stands for Network File System, do is that they have this concept of a mount point. Okay. So here what happens is every host in your system has a set of local names for remote locations. Okay. Well, and then there's a table called a mount table that is specified as a configuration file on that machine that specifies for every remote server that you want to access, it specifies a local name that you can use to access it. Okay? And when the machine boots up, it creates this mapping saying if the user tries to access this local name, this needs to map to this remote file name. Okay? There's a mapping between local names and remote names that gets created at boot time. Okay. So the user from this point on can access files as if they were local files without having to worry about where the file is actually stored, what server it's stored on. Okay. So the example I gave you earlier, right, of the EdLab directory where you have courses CS300. This is an example of a mount point. You are actually accessing your files for your 377 course without knowing where it is stored. Okay? Because internally the system administrator has actually created the mapping for you. You just access this directory and the operating system knows where to go in order to fetch the file. So you access files as if they were local and the mapping is maintained for you by the operating system. Okay? This is location transparent. And the remote file name can change across reboot. So if you actually change that mapping in that FS tab, okay, then when you reboot the system, then the same file will get a different name. And I'll show you some examples. Okay. Now, let's look at some quick examples and then... okay, so here is... What is this? Okay, so this is your EdLab machine. Okay. So here are all the mounts that have been created. So you can actually see that internally when the machine boots up, what is in courses/CS300 is actually mapped on into this server. Okay, that's EL server 4 courses 300. Okay, this mapping was created by the system administrator. So when the machine boots up, it actually created this mapping. So on this machine, your CS300 files are not local to this EdLab machine. It's actually, the files are stored on the server, but you access them as if it's local. You just say /courses/300, and internally the OS knows that every access to files in that directory actually have to be sent to that server. Yes, you have to do that, of course. At some level, you have to do that. Point is, it's being hidden from users. Okay? The system administrator has set up the mapping for you. Okay, when users access files, it's location transparent. Okay? So when you actually go into your CS300 directory, you don't worry about whether it was on L server 4 or L server 3. So and the file name doesn't reveal that information to you. /courses/CS300/377 doesn't tell you the server name, it doesn't embed the server name. Okay? That's the point being said here. Okay? So let's look at the FS tab on this machine, which is where this mapping is maintained. So it will have all of these entries in there. So you can see that there are all these entries that happen. So here are all the EL server 4 and there are mappings for every directory, and it says this is using an FS and there are some mount options and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is set up for you, okay, by administrators, and when the machine boots up, all of these mappings get activated, and you just have to access these files, okay, and the system does the rest for you. That's the point to keep in mind. Any questions on this?
What's the soft and hard
option? Well, what are the soft and hard options? So hard boot basically says that if the server becomes unavailable, then you have to wait. You block, the machine is not going to do anything. Soft just says that you can, if the mapping may fail, and the machine, you can let it boot up. And if you say hard map, then the server is unavailable, the machine is just going to wait for the server to become available. So use that for critical volume that must be mounted. Otherwise, the machine shouldn't even boot. That's the point. Okay, so one disadvantage of this strategy is that you cannot enforce that a particular file on a server somewhere will have the same name on all machines that NFS mounted. Okay, that's not something you can do it, but you cannot enforce it. You cannot guarantee it. Okay, why is that? People name file differently, okay. What does that mean exactly from this perspective?
Because
So the mapping between remote files and local files is specified on a per workstation basis in this configuration file FSTA. Okay. So each machine can use its own mapping scheme. There is no requirement that all workstations have to use the same mapping scheme. So for example, one machine, so the machine that we just saw basically mapped EL server, whatever, courses, CS300 to a local directory called courses CS300. Okay. So other machine can have the same FSTA and it can map this to something called files CS300. Okay. So on this other machine, you can get to the same directory with this name. Okay. You basically do cd/files CS300 and that will get mapped to this directory. Okay. On this machine, you have to use this name. Okay. So since the files FS tab can be configured as you want on each workstation, okay, it's hard for you to enforce that a single naming scheme is going to become available on all machines. Different volumes may get mounted under different names on different machines. Now if the administrator ensures that the FS tab file is the same on all workstations, okay, then you can get to the same file in the same way. In EdLab, for example, all workstations actually use the same FSTA. Okay? This is why on every machine you can go and do cd/courses300 and you get into the same directory. But that's not a necessity. Okay, I can go and modify the FS tab on my machine and that volume will get mounted somewhere else. Okay, yes, question.
Couldn't that disadvantage just be considered a networking administrator mistake?
Yes. But there are file systems that will guarantee you this as opposed to administrator setting it up for you. Okay? That's the point I'm trying to make here. Okay? In the Windows world, this is equivalent to saying the F drive on every machine is going to map to the same volume. Okay? Now you might take the volume and some machines you might have assigned it a F drive and some other machine you may assign it a Z drive. Okay, and then you have this problem where you have different names for the same file on different machines. Okay, so there is something to keep in mind that it's not a unified strategy. So I already mentioned /fstab. This is just showing the file that I just showed you. Yeah, this doesn't look visible.
I got another question.
Yes.
Can those errors only be made in the FS tab?
So the FS tab actually keeps track of these mapping. And it's not necessarily an error. There may be a good reason why you may want to mount a certain volume differently on some machines. Okay, so then you would actually do it differently for a good reason, not because it was an error. It could be an error, but in more cases than not, it is because I want to use a different naming scheme on this machine and a different naming scheme on that other machine. Okay. Alright, so this thing is just not visible, so let me draw it. So what this is showing is exactly what happens as part of the mount protocol. Yeah, so here you have a server. And it has some files. Courses. And then here your client. So what happens as part of the mount protocol is that you take a subtree of the files stored on some server and attach it to the file hierarchy on the client machine. Okay, so in this case, what will happen is, no color. So what's going to happen is you will take this subtree, okay, from this server and you are going to attach it. In this case, you are going to attach it to the root. You don't have, you can attach it anywhere you want. Okay. So this is what the mount protocol does. It takes this subtree and it basically logically attaches it at this location, which is called the mount point in this file hierarchy. Okay. From this point on, this subtree looks like it's local to this machine. Okay. So this basically appears here as courses and CS300 and whatnot. Okay, that's essentially what the mount protocol allows you to do. You can take any arbitrary subtree from any machine and export it. Okay, export process just says that I give permission to some clients to attach this subtree on their local machine. Okay. First, the server has to export volumes. Okay, if you don't export volumes, then the client request for mounting that volume will be denied. Okay, so server has to give permission to the client to export it. So that is done using the file called /etc/exports. Yeah, or there are similar named files on different machines. So you can say I export these volumes from this machine. Okay, and then the client has to mount these volumes using FSTAB. Okay, and boot time, you read the FSTAB and you take different subtrees and then you basically make local mounts which attaches those subtrees. Okay, you're not restricted to mounting from one server. You can mount arbitrary number of volumes from arbitrary number of servers. Okay, and extend your local file hierarchy using NFS mounts. Okay, any questions on this? Okay. Now most file systems on other options, so NFS is just one example. Other file systems use similar principle. Okay. So if you want to just do the same kind of stuff on Mac using, let's say, Apple file protocol, what you would do is you will actually first you have to do equivalent of an export, which means on the Mac you go into settings and you go into sharing, and then you turn on file sharing. Okay, so now my public folder has basically become available. I can specify which users can access it. I can also specify in certain flavors which machines can access it. Here I'm specifying access by user as opposed to access by machine. Now I can also say which protocol I want to use. Okay. So here by default you use the Apple file protocol. You can also share files using Samba, which is the Windows file sharing protocol. Okay. And here it uses FTP, which we know. Okay. So once you have done this, once you actually export, so this basically turns on sharing and it says I've exported. Then what you have to do is from any other client you go and you attach. Okay, so let's try to do that. And the way you do this on a Mac, on NFS you will use file FSTAB, but if you are using this protocol, what you would do is you would basically go to the finder and you will say go and connect to server. Okay, and here now you can actually specify the name. So here is a let's just check that works. Seems very slow.
Now, is it finding the ones on our servers because you have that set up already, or is it because
No, you can type in whatever you want, actually, it doesn't matter. So here it's going to, let's say, okay, so these are the volumes that have been exported. Okay, so it shows you all the volumes that are exported, and you can pick a volume and you can mount it. Okay, so here is that volume. So it basically becomes, it appears in your finder, and these are all the files. You can also open up a terminal and see the same thing. Okay, so here is that volume. This is the volume from that machine. It got mounted as /volumes, that thing. Okay, so you can actually, now at this point this gets a local name, exactly the way in NFS. So now what you do to access it is you basically say /volumes, and you do this, and here are all the files there. Okay, so you have all these files on that. So they look local, but now internally the operating system knows that there is a mount that has gotten point that's gotten created, and it's actually accessing a remote machine. Okay. It also shows up on your desktop, which you can actually, you can just unmount it. So that's the same thing that happens in NFS, except that you're using configuration files as opposed to a GUI to do this, do all the mounts and the exports and whatnot. Okay, so we looked at absolute file names. Okay, we looked at NFS mounts, and the third naming strategy that's used in file systems is what's called a global namespace. Okay, in a global name, so there are file systems like CMU's Andrew file system and Berkeley's Sprite file system, which is basically a research file system that enforce a global naming convention. Okay. So basically, no matter which node you are on, you can access the file with a single globally unique name. Okay, the file name doesn't depend on which machine you are accessing it from. Okay. Now, the simplest way to think about this is to actually think about the web. Okay. Web also uses a single global namespace. Every file on that's accessible via any web server anywhere in the world has a unique name, and the unique name is its URL. Okay, URL stands for unique resource locator. Okay, same is true here. It doesn't matter which browser you are accessing it from, it which machine. If you say, if you type cnn.com/index.html, you get to that file, okay, which is CNN's homepage. Okay, so the same is true in files in these file systems. So no matter which node you are on, every file gets a globally unique name, and you can access that using its handle, okay, or its name from any machine. Okay. Now in these file systems, you have a set of workstation clients and a set of dedicated file server machines. Okay. When the client starts up, it gets the naming structure from the server. Okay, this is where the web analogy breaks down. When your browser starts up, it doesn't go contacting all the web servers and say, give me your file hierarchy. Okay. But in this file distributed file system, these clients will actually contact the server that they know about and import their file structure. Okay. Now, when the user accesses files, what happens is the server actually sends a copy of the file to the workstation. And the workstation does all of its operation on a local copy. So all of the reads and writes happen locally, and at some later time this file is sent back to the server. An updated version of the file is sent back to the server. Okay. Now what are some advantages and disadvantages of a global namespace? First one is naming is consistent. Okay. There is only one way to get to every file, and there is a unique way. Doesn't matter what machine you are on. Okay. And the namespace is going to be independent of which machine and how you access it and so on. So, and in this case, the name binding is late, so you can actually move a file around. Okay, this is not true in the web, okay, but it is true in this file system. If you move a file, sometimes its name may not change depending on the file system. You can continue to get to it using the same name. Okay, that gives you location independence. Okay, web is not location independent, but some of these naming schemes are. Okay. Now, disadvantages are that you have a caching problem. So what happens in this file system is the moment you access a file, the file is actually brought over to the local workstation, and you start doing all of your reads and writes locally. Okay? If multiple users on different workstations start accessing the same file, you have a problem. Okay? You are going to overwrite each other's updates. Okay? Or if one user has started accessing a file and updated it locally, the server still has the old version. Another user may ask for the file and get an older version of the file. That's also a problem. Okay. So caching becomes a problem. Global namespace may sometimes limit flexibility, and there may be some performance problems in creating a globally unique namespace. All of that has to be implemented in the file system. Okay. So let's look at this problem in a lot more detail. Okay, the caching problem is your question there.
Who controls the domain if the global names are limited? Who really
okay, that's a good question. So who controls the name namespace? Because if there's one namespace, then every file has to be given one name. So the way it depends on the file system. So in Andrew, you actually use a URL-like structure. Okay, so the way you actually access any file in the Andrew file system, okay, you don't even need a mount table or anything like that. So what you just do is you do cd slash AFS, it stands for the Andrew File System, and you actually specify a server name. So let's say you say CS. Okay, that's this. Okay. So you will do CD and you will basically do this. Courses. Okay. And then your file system will automatically mount that volume for you. Okay. Now this is a URL like naming convention. You have the file name, you have the server name, and you have the structure on that server. Okay. If you, and this is how you actually create a globally unique namespace, because every server name is actually embedded in the file name, in the file path. Okay, so there is a root directory, but you also specify this. Okay. So if you do this, then you have no need to control. So long as every machine has a unique IP address and a name on the internet, all you do is you do CD AFS, you specify either an IP address or the name of the machine, and you mount all of the volumes that are available on that machine. And Andrew allows you to share across domains. So you can mount any Andrew volume anywhere in the world, so long as that machine has actually given global mount privileges. If the machine doesn't want to share its file, then you cannot mount it. Yes, question there. Right. So there are many models to share a file. A web is an example of a model where you can actually share file. Think of a web as a read-only system. You don't update file. You can download and access file. Same is true of FTP. You download it. Okay? In a typical file system, you have the ability to create, manipulate directory structures, ability to read, write files. All of those are available exactly the way they are local files. Now it is true that other file sharing techniques are beginning to look somewhat like file systems. Okay? So, but they are not traditional file systems in that sense. They are just ways to access remote files. They are not file systems in the pure sense. Okay, FTP is just a way to download a remote file from a server. Right. So, a music sharing system, those are called peer-to-peer file sharing systems. Okay, so those are somewhere in between FTP and traditional file systems. Okay, so they actually embed a lot of file system features in them. Okay, they're distributed file system features. But the boundary is not very clear where you can draw a line and say everything on this side is a pure file system and everything else just allows you to access remote files but is not. Okay, there's a whole spectrum. Is a way to think about it. Any other questions here? Okay. So let's look at this particular problem. Okay. So how to keep file systems consistent with caching. So before I do actually talk about caching, let me go back to what I mentioned briefly last time as to how distributed file systems actually work. Okay, so we have just talked about naming so far. How can you actually name files? We didn't really talk about how the file system allows you access to these remote files. Okay, so let's try to understand that a little bit. Okay, so here is a server. So let's. Here is a disk. There is a file. This is the server. Here is a client. Okay, it also has a local disk. And it has access to this remote disk. Okay. So now let's take some app here, okay, some application process, okay, that wants to access this file. Okay. Let's assume all the mount point, etc., everything has been set up. So it opens the file. Okay. It specifies the file name, and let's say it says open. Okay. And then it starts doing reads and writes to the file. So you redo some read, write, so on. Okay. Now, how does the distributed file system actually implement or execute this file operation? Okay. So, there are two techniques as have been mentioned there. One is called remote service And the other one is, I haven't given a name, but it's called the upload-download mod. Okay. Now, if you want to read, let's say, the 10th byte of the file, what should the client operating system do? It has two options. One is it can actually forward this operation to the server and say, just perform this operation and send me back the result. Okay. So you say, read the 10th byte, you just send this over and tell the server, read the 10th byte. Okay, read 1 kilobyte starting at this offset. Server executes the call and it reads that part of the file and it sends it back to the client. Okay. So in one case, you just basically blindly forwarded every request over to the server, has the server execute them, and you get back the results. Okay. The other one is called the upload-download model. In this model, the first time you open the file, entire copy of the file is brought over and is stored on the local disk. So now that's the initial copy. So when you open the file, you brought the file over. Okay, now you have a local copy. So from this point on, all of these operations, read and write and all of these, actually operate on this local copy. Okay, so you say read the 10th byte, you just go to your local copy and you do it. The server is no longer involved beyond the initial open. Okay, in executing all these operations, they all happen on the local copy. And when you say close, okay, at this point, this file is actually sent back to the server saying here is a new version of this file. So this old version of the file gets replaced by the new version. Okay? So there are two techniques. One is a remote service where every request from every client is actually sent to the server for processing. Server does all the work, okay, and just sends you back results. The other technique is one where you open a file, a remote file, and you just bring a local copy and you do all of the operations locally. Okay? Now, what are some advantages and disadvantages of these two approaches? Yes.
Well, if you get the file from the server and put it on a local copy, and another client gets the same copy from the server, you both need to update. Then the second one that actually makes it is going to be the one that actually gets updated.
Right. So in the latter case, okay, you have what's called a consistency problem. Okay, if two clients on two different applications or processes on two different machines open the same file, each gets their local copy, and if they start modifying the file, you are going to have problems. Okay, because these modifications made by this client are not visible to that one and vice versa. Okay. When you close the file, then one of them is going to override changes done by the other. Okay. So this is called a consistency problem where file change modifications are not visible to clients. Okay. This is not going to be true in case of the remote service, because every operation is sent to the server, all changes to the files are visible immediately. Okay. Client 1 basically says append 1 byte to this file, so you append a byte, and if this client says read something, this new version of the file becomes accessible to it. It can read this immediately. Okay. Not a problem. So all file changes are visible immediately to everyone. Yeah, that's not true in this case, in the previous case. Okay. Now, what are some disadvantages? Okay. Remember that there's a network between the client and the server. Okay. And this could be a slow network, or this could be a server that's far away, okay, from a network perspective from the client. So in the remote service, every request has to be sent to the server. Okay. So if this is a slow network, then the latency of every request is going to be slow. If you say read 1 kilobyte from this server and then it takes you 10 milliseconds to send a request, all of your operations are going to slow down, because every request has to traverse over a network to the server and a response has to be sent back. Okay? So performance is going to be slow in the remote service model. Okay? Consistency is going to be better, performance is going to be worse. That's not true in the caching model or upload-download model, because all operations are local. Once you get the file, okay, there's no latency anymore. Every access looks like a local disk access, not a remote network access. Okay, so you get better performance. You do have to pay this one-time cost of bringing the file over. Okay, if this is a large file, then the cost of bringing the file over at file open time is high. Okay? If this is a 1 kilobyte file, you bring 1 kilobyte over the network. If this is a 10 megabyte file, you bring 10 megabytes over. Even if you want to just, even if you open this file, read one byte and close the file, you brought a 10 megabyte file over. Okay? So initial cost of bringing the file over is high, and that may not be amortized by file operations. Okay? But on the other hand, once you bring the file over, the performance is much better. Okay? Or everything is local. You don't have to send anything over the network. Okay, now let's look at, so we'll not talk about remote service anymore, but talk about this problem. Okay, you have multiple clients accessing the same file. Okay, how can you deal with this problem of consistency? How can you ensure that to the extent possible, clients are not going to get outdated versions of the data or files from the remote server? So yes, question. Right. So simplest thing is you don't let concurrency, problem solved. If this guy says I want to access this file, says too bad, somebody else is accessing it, try again later. Okay, yes, question.
What if there was only a read-only access?
If it's read-only, then there is no problem. This does not have consistency is only when some clients are updating, others are reading. Okay. There has to be at least one writer in the system for consistency to even arise. If nobody modifies the file, there is no problem. Okay. It's the same as the web. Okay. You have a browser cache. Okay. Your web browser actually has an on-disk cache if you actually looked at setting. If nobody is modifying the file on the server, whatever is in your cache is always going to be up to date with respect to the server. There is no problem. Okay. On the other hand, if your browser starts caching something like CNN web page, which gets updated every minute or every 2 minutes, then and if it actually gives you the locally cached copy, it's going to be stale. You need to get an outdated version. Okay? So because in the latter case that the page is actually getting updated by someone. Okay? So consistency problems arise. Okay? If you are caching, consistency problems arise only if there's at least one client updating or multiple clients updating. If everybody is reading, nobody is updating, this is not a problem. Okay? Then caching won't really work. Okay, so you can put a block. Yes, I mean, I just said you could restrict writes altogether. But that's not a good file system. If your file system says you cannot modify the files, okay, you the user not happy. Okay, so you want a file system to solve your problem, not create problems for you by saying you cannot update files. So cache consistency techniques actually try to ensure that when files are modified, somehow you are notified. Yeah, so now this is a general problem whenever there is caching. This has nothing to do with file system. Okay? In your CPU, you have an instruction cache. We talked about caching when we were doing paging, if you remember. There was a TLB cache. Same thing happens when there are multiple writers. If you have a multiple processor or a multi-core machine and there's a local cache and one CPU actually modifies something in the cache, another CPU tries to access it and goes to RAM, and RAM has an old version of that variable, you have the same cache consistency problem. Okay, so cache consistency arises anywhere there is caching and writers, okay, that are actually modifying the data. Okay, but the solutions you use to address cache consistency may differ depending on the scenario. Okay, distributed file systems may employ different cache consistency techniques than, let's say, a processor, okay, in hardware. So caching issues are where would you store this file that you brought over. Okay, I showed you that is actually stored on disk. That doesn't have to be the case. You can store it in RAM, you can store it in disk. Okay, but you do bring a copy over. When are the modifications sent back? Okay, and what happens if multiple clients cache the same file? That's our consistency problem. Okay, so let's start with the first one. Okay, this is simpler. This is where I think it gets tricky. Okay, so let's talk about where the blocks are cached. So there are two options when you bring a file over from the server. You can store it in RAM, you can store it on your local disk. Okay? Because you brought a file over and you are going to make local modifications, reads or writes. Where do you store this file? Okay, you can store it in memory, you can store it on disk. What are advantages and disadvantages? Okay. If you store it on disk, you basically have effectively lot of storage. be unlimited. There's no limit on the number of files you can bring. Your file disk size may be what, several hundreds of gigabytes. So you can bring lots of file over, open lots of files. There won't be any constraint on storage space. Okay. This is also safe if the node is going to fail, meaning that if you reboot your machine, okay, if the file that you brought over was on disk, the file will still stay there when your machine comes back. Okay. If your files were stored in RAM and your machine shuts down and you reboot or you hibernate or whatever, then some of this content may disappear, okay, because RAM is a non-volatile medium. Okay. Disadvantage of storing on disk is that it is slow. Yes, compared to RAM, accesses to disks are several orders of magnitude slower. If you had actually kept this in RAM and you did reads and writes to a memory file that's in memory, that application will execute much faster than if it has to go to local disk. Okay. All that said, storing it on local disk is still faster than going to a remote server. Okay, that you should keep in mind. That's why it says access time is reduced as compared to remote access. Okay, not as compared to storing it in RAM. Okay, and everything is true for the opposite in case of if you store the file or cache it in RAM, quicker access times. Okay, does not tolerate node failures. Cache size is limited. Okay, because that's limited by RAM size, not by disk size. And this will work with what are called diskless workstation. Okay, if the machine doesn't have a disk, only option you have is to bring it to RAM. Okay, now let's talk about the second question, which is where I think the more interesting issues arise, which is how are modifications propagated back to the remote server. Okay, that tells you what happens when another client accesses it. Yes, question.
When you say works with diskless workstations, shouldn't that be an advantage? But I don't get that.
Oh, actually, I think you're right. That should be an advantage, not a disadvantage. Yeah, yeah. Good point. Any question? Other question here? Okay, so there are many policies that you can use to employ or to ensure what's called cache consistency. Okay, and basically it all boils down to when will the local machine send back the changes to the server. Okay. The more you delay sending changes back, the worse you are going to have. The worst problem you are going to have in terms of consistency, meaning other clients that try to access the file start getting stale data, old versions of the file, outdated content and whatnot. Okay? The more frequently you update or send back modification, the better off you are in terms of consistency. This is a general trade-off. Okay? There's nothing to do with file system. This is basically things very intuitive. Okay? And so that gives you these two ends of the spectrum. One is called a write-through cache. You may have heard of this write-through caching and write-back caching. Write-through cache basically says that every time you make a local modification, okay, to a file that is cached locally, send those modifications to the server. Okay, meaning the write actually goes through the cache and hits the remote copy as well. That's why it's called a write-through cache. Okay. Now this will guarantee you good consistency, meaning that no users will never see stale data, because every time you modify it locally, you send those modifications off to the remote server. Okay, good consistency, but what's the problem with the approach?
Too much modification leads to poor performance.
Okay, too many modifications lead to poor performance. Write through caching, basically if you do write through caching, then you have to ask, why are you even caching it locally? Okay. You might have just, it's no different from remote service, because every write is going to the server. It's hitting the cache and it's going to the server. Okay. So performance will slow down because all writes will see a network latency. Okay. But caching does offer you some benefits because reads don't go to the server. Only writes go to the server. Okay. Is this clear? Now, the other end of the spectrum is called write back. Write back basically says all modifications are made local and only at some later time do you send the file over. Okay, this is what we have been thinking of implicitly. Okay, this is called write back caching, where you only make local modifications and send the file later. Yeah, this reduces network traffic, can only send files once in a while. But the problem, of course, is that if any other client accesses the file, they get stale content. Okay? Now, the cache consistency problem doesn't stop here. This is just saying when are writes sent to the server. Yeah, this does not tell you what happens to other clients that are accessing the file. Okay, so let's just take this example. Okay, client one opens the file, you bring a copy of the file and store it locally. Client two opens the same file, okay, a copy is sent here. Okay, so now let's assume write through caching. Okay, so this client actually goes and writes to this file. Okay, this write is immediately sent to the server. Okay, so now the copy at the server is up to date. Okay, now let's assume this client then subsequently reads this file. What's going to happen? You do open, then this client does open. After both have opened the file, you do a write here. Okay, and then once the write finishes, you do a read here. Will you see the more recent version of the file or the old version of the file? I'm sorry? Yeah, on this client. You'll see the old one. Why?
Because they got the same copy at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. So, when each of them opened the file, they brought a copy over. Okay. Now, this guy modified it, and you're doing write through. So, every modification is sent immediately off to the server. So, this client has sent off its write to the server. But that didn't solve our problem. This client still is keeping an old version of the file. Okay? So why do we have this problem? We thought that write through is actually going to improve the situation for us, but looks like it hasn't done anything. What can we do to address this problem? Send a notification. Okay? Yeah, that's true. For the client. So there are that's basically it. So there are two ways to address it. So the caching has two parts to it. Okay? One is whenever something is modified, send that over to the server. Okay? The second part is once the server receives update, then it has to tell other clients that are accessing the file that the file has changed. Okay? So there are always two parts. One is to update the file at the server. The other one is to let other clients know. Okay? Now, the simplest thing that the server can do is whenever the file changes, it sends a notification, okay, to every client that has this file open. Okay? That's a simple thing to do. But to do this, you have to make the server stateful. Okay? The server has to keep state of which clients in its system has which files open. Okay. So, if this file server is serving, let's say, 100 clients, 100 machines, and each of them has, let's say, 20 files open, it has to keep this state in the system. Okay. So, you may have state for thousands of files that are currently open that you have to keep, because every time any file changes, you need to know which clients have this file open and send notifications to them. Okay. This makes the server stateful. Okay. If the state is maintained in memory, which is often the case, if the server crashes, then the state disappears. Then you no longer know who has opened which file. Because the files are all local, if you remember. So this client can go accessing its file without any knowledge of the server. The server can reboot in the meantime. The file is still local. Okay? So cache notifications of updates by the server, okay, are stateful. Okay? Meaning that so long as you are willing to pay the overhead of maintaining state, this is okay. Okay? Now what are some other ways to do this that may not have this problem? How do you know when the file has changed? Yes.
It could have some sort of fail-safe journaling paired with a locking list, so that
What did you just say?
Some sort of fail-safe journaling with a locking system. Also,
if you know, user accesses a file, if they receive a file for that file, then exclusive access to avoid that transactional conflicts. And then for each write back or write through request that it receives, it keeps a log in the distributed file system header on the server and the client. And then if the server goes down and comes back up, the clients can compare their transactional logs with each other. And then any logs, assuming the clients are trusted, of course, but any discrepancies, you can play back those transactions very much like a database.
Right. But this is only, so what you are saying is every client keeps track of what changes it has made. It also sends it to the server.
Right.
That does not address the problem of when the file changes.
Right.
How do you tell all the clients that the file has changed?
Well,
so you don't keep an old version of the file.
Well, the lock, basically. If they don't have a lock.
If you lock things, that's a different issue. But we are not assuming any locks in the system.
Lockless.
Yes. Yes, you have something.
I don't know if this is better than the yellow one, but you probably just keep a list of all the files you have on the server and the state of them.
Mm-hmm. Where? Where do you keep the list?
Huh?
Where would you keep this list? Okay, so that's the state. Okay, so you have a list.
And you're going to require the clients to check on the file state every time.
Okay.
And update it every time.
Actually, you do it with access time. So, logs the access time, the first thing is the file. Goes to check if it's changed.
Right. So, there are two techniques to figure out whether data that you have cached has changed or not. Either you put the burden on the server or you put the burden on the client. There are only two components in the system. In the first case, whenever the server receives a write to the file, it has kept track of which clients have the file open, so it sends notification. Okay? So that's called server push. In the second case, we have what is called client pull or client pool. Pull. Okay, equivalent. So in this case, the client is the responsibility of the client to check with the server every so often they have the file change. So before, if the read request comes here, the client can go to the server and say, has this file changed? Or should I just go with my local copy? Okay, and then the server can say, it has changed or not. It can send a yes, no response. If the response is no, then the read can continue. Okay. So either you have the server send you notifications whenever the file changes, or it's up to the client to keep checking with the server. Okay? If you do either of these two, then you have guaranteed consistency without blocking clients saying, I have opened the file, so you cannot open the file. Not a good idea, right? Applications don't like that. Or without employing locks, which you have, if you have two independent applications and one of them locks the file, the other application doesn't even know who owns the lock, why is this file locked. So you cannot do these things in distributed file system because independent entities may be accessing and modifying files. Okay, so to allow arbitrary clients to access arbitrary files and yet ensure that every client actually has an up-to-date view of what is happening on the server, you have to ensure these things. Meaning you have to ensure something like write-through caching or some periodic way to flush your updates to the server, and either the server notifies all clients or clients keep polling the server. Okay? Yes, question.
How do you ensure per write consistency? So like for example, say you have two clients and one's starting to write a change from file back to the server client, I guess. But then another client starts to modify it while that other client
right.
Is modifying it. How do you deal with that?
So the thing to distinguish is consistency is not the same as synchronization.
True.
Okay. So consistency only says that I will try to always return the most recent version of the data to you. Okay. If I read the file and the file is changing while you are reading it, I still return the most recent write that has finished, not writes that are ongoing. Okay.
So a single write will be...
Yes. Solid. Synchronization actually allows you to control. You can actually block writes while other things are up. So these are two different things.
Okay.
Okay, so consistency not the same as synchronization. Okay, synchronization requires locks. consistency doesn't need locks. It just says, I'll try to return the most up-to-date version of the data I have. Okay, the data may be changing while I try to service read, but that's okay. Whatever I have until now, I'll return to. So basically, so long as you return the right thing, it's fine. If you need to actually coordinate them, then that's a synchronization problem. That requires locks. Because now this has become a globally shared file and you want to coordinate access to the file. Okay, so file systems by definition don't impose locking. But to implement any synchronization, you will need locking, yes.
Well, what do the clients usually try to pull for the information? Does that happen before they try to write to the file, or
so that gives you, I mean, it basically answer is it depends. So there is no one technique to poll. You can have a whole spectrum of strategies. You can poll every so often. There's periodic polling. I poll every second. Okay. Now if the file changes between two polls, tough luck. You still got some outdated content. Yeah, but you can get basically up to 1 second old content. If you can live with that, fine. If you always want the most up-to-date content, you have to poll prior to every file operation. That's the only way to guarantee that I'll never work on outdated version of the file. Every time there's a read or the write, I first poll and make sure what I have is up-to-date, and then I let the operation continue. If the file has changed, I have to bring the new file and then do the operation on that file. Okay? So those are the extremes. Yes?
When working through like PuTTY, I noticed that sometimes when it crashes, and you go to re-access a document, you see that there's been a temporary file created in its stead. Is that similar to what happens when you go to write access to a file? It creates a temporary one, and until the temporary one has been completed.
Yeah. Well, actually, it doesn't. No, it. No, that's not what this thing does. So your temporary files are created by your editor. Because editors have what's called an auto-saving feature, where even though you may not explicitly save, every so often if you have modified the file, it just keeps saving to disk. Okay, just so that you can recover. In a file system, you don't do that. A read comes and a write comes. You just basically have a queue for every file. You have a queue of requests. There's a read followed by write followed by read that are all coming from different clients. You are just processing them in this order. So read comes, you just read, send it. Write comes, you update the file. The next read that comes, you'll read the file. Yeah, so you don't make temporary copies, you just change the actual file itself directly.
Oh, alright, I was confused when you said if someone was modifying it and another person was trying to read it, you said that the reader is an older version.
Well, what I was saying is, if a read and a write came more or less at the same time, this read basically may be the write. Request has arrived here, so it's in progress, but it hasn't completed. Yeah, because this client has issued a write, so it's in progress, it hasn't finished. This read will actually read whatever is already been whatever is already in this file, and go back, and then the write will finish and update the file. And I said that's okay. That's all I was trying to say. Reads that are in progress that haven't finished don't really block any writes that are in progress that haven't finished don't block out any reads. Those reads will actually go and read what's already written to the file. That's all I was trying to say. Okay, anything else? So here are two techniques. This is the server poll and the client pull. Client initiated consistency, or client contacts the server and asks if the copy is consistent. So responsibility of consistency that the client, you can check on every access. This is what we just said. If you want to ensure you need the freshest copy, check every access. Otherwise, do this periodically. Okay, between any two checks, you may get outdated content, and that's okay. Server-initiated consistency basically says every time the server receives a write, it keeps track of all the clients that are opened the file and sends them notification. The file has changed. It's your job to get the new version. Okay. So here, the server has to be stateful. Okay. It also needs to know what mode the clients have opened the file, which ones are readers and which ones are writers and whatnot. Okay. So these are the two techniques. This is true in most caching techniques, although we have talked about this in the context of file systems. Anytime you are caching and cache consistency, somebody has to take the burden of ensuring that the cache is consistent. It's either the server or the client. Okay. Quick case study. Well, I'll just start this. Yes, question.
Is it appropriate in that system to where Say client A sends a message to the server to delete the file,
mm-hmm.
where the client has the file open, and if it's still writing,
yes.
then wouldn't it still say, okay, well, this is a new file, it can write to it? So is there something that has to change with
well, if you... So there are all these issues you have to handle in distributed file system. One client is accessing the file, some other client somewhere goes and deletes it. What should you do? Should you? So basically you can give the illusion that the file has been deleted to this client, but keep the file there, but hidden, so that this client can continue to do operation. Once it closes it, then you delete it. The other thing is you delete it immediately, so then any further reads and writes here get an error saying somebody deleted the file, so I cannot do anything. So you have to choose. This depends on the policy. There is no right way. You decide what behavior you want to implement, and that's what your file system will provide to clients or applications. Okay. So I think we have run out of time here. So let's stop for the day. There are two things that I wanted to do. One is there are a whole bunch of homeworks, projects, and you maybe even exams that people have not collected. Okay, so I have everything here. If you haven't collected projects 2 or 3 or homework 2, okay, your copy is here. Okay. And then the second thing is course evaluations. You want to administer this? If you can spend 5 more minutes in class and actually do the evaluation, that would be good. Okay, let me go get some pencils. Okay. Who's asking this? Yes. I will give it. Okay, so why don't you hand it out? I'll get pencils in.